This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Hello, this is Sterling Allen with Free Energy Now. You can reach us every day at freeenergynews.com, or you can come online and see our past shows and upcoming shows for this Free Energy Now segment at freeenergynow.net. We have as our guest today Joe Longo of StarTech Environmental Corporation. It's the only publicly traded waste-to-energy plasma arc technology company in the world. They presently have 3 5-ton-a-day installations in operation with a number of other plants in various stages of implementation. And a 200-ton-a-day plant is being built by StarTech in Panama, which will be the largest such plant in the world. They are featured this month, March, issue of what magazine is that? The Popular Science magazine.
It is.
Joe, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Sterling, for having me.
So, this technology, very exciting. There are actually quite a number of plasma arc companies out there. I know of about 3 to 5, MagnaGas one being one that comes right to mind. I've interviewed him on this show before, Mr. Santilli. And other technologies, you're the only publicly traded one, huh?
Yes, Sterling, we are. That's important. We're probably the longest in the industry, and at the moment, we seem to have the field all to ourselves. We seem to have it, but there's plenty of room in the industry for competition.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about plasma arc, this is basically... Well, we'll put it in layman's term in terms of the bottom line function of what you're doing. You're turning waste into energy. Can we maybe elaborate on that just briefly, what
yes,
the plasma arc process is about?
And what we want to do is differentiate the euphemism of waste to energy facilities that are fundamentally incinerators. What we do, the plasma system breaks apart the molecular bonds of the materials, whether they're waste, well, not waste. Waste is a subjective term anyway, and can invariably forms those molecules, the carbons and the hydrogens and oxygens and so forth, into a synthesis gas that can then be used for many uses, uses as a feedstock. And the principal one that we're very active in at the moment is the use of the synthesis gas to produce ethanol and ultra-low sulfur diesel fuels, and even jet fuels.
Hmm. What would be your low-hanging fruit for the inflow?
Well, the immediate new contracts coming to us, if that's what I believe you mean, is a project in Barceloneta, Puerto Rico, wherein they're taking pharmaceutical industrial waste and producing propane. And I should say, it's not, the center of gravity of the plasma converter is not to produce what we call back-end commodity products. It's focused on the destruction of waste, particularly the hazardous and troublesome waste. As a result of doing that, however, some other good derivative things can happen.
Now, are you focusing on the destruction of hazardous waste because it has much higher tipping fee at this point, making it more economical until you can get the scale economies of scale down to go to maybe some of the less tipping fee type of scenarios such as sewage or even municipal waste?
Yes, Sterling, that's exactly right. We have, for example, the other projects in China that the contracts we have are for PCBs and a material called POPs, a silly name for what means persistent organic pollutants, nasty things. And those are only 10-ton-a-day systems, But the processors get a very, very high tipping fee to take those materials in, and they, the processors doing that, are really not interested in producing electricity at the back end or alternative fuels, that, you know, because it's very profitable to get rid of the materials with the tipping fees at the front end.
And you are also, in addition to getting rid of the these persistent organic pollutants, you're also generating the syngas on the output side.
Yes, we are. whether we wanted to or not, that's what is produced now. The fellows in China who are having the systems are really not, they're going to use that PCG, the syngas, for a little bit of plant heating and cooling, but they're really not quite interested in it because the big money, so to speak, is at the front end, the tipping fees. On the other hand, in Panama, where we have 200 tons a day, they are interested in recovering the plasma-converted gas, the synthesis gas, at the back end. And while initially they were going to be focused on using it to produce electricity, recently their interest has moved to a more lucrative area of, again, producing alternative fuels.
Just by way of introduction to you, we introduced your company, but we didn't introduce you. You are the CEO of the company, is that correct?
Yes, StarTech Environmental Corporation, a founder and all of that. And my background is, I guess, besides being an engineer, is in the waste capital equipment for the waste industry. And the plasma converter system is really a rather advanced product development on a long trail of capital equipment machinery we produce for the waste industry, even at a time when the waste industry wasn't even a waste industry. It was just garbage collectors and such.
You said earlier that you're the largest in the industry. How long have you been in the industry, and how are you defining largest in terms of volume or size of your company?
Well, I guess we boastfully consider ourselves the leaders by way of the fact that we literally do not face a competitor at any time. And we don't mind doing that because we'd be happy to do that. But we don't see any competitors around, although there is room for competition. But we have been in, unlike even some of the others who boast of a plasma capability, we ourselves come from the industry in which so many would hope to prosper, and we come from the waste industry, capital equipment, and we know it thoroughly and deeply, and that's a great market advantage over anyone else. We started at that time, back in 1968, even before there was such a thing as an EPA or an Earth Day or very much environmental awareness. At that time, if you played the word game, a word association of environmental people would have associated that with how the conditions at the home to bring up children as to whether or not they'll develop into good citizens. And if someone said word association with ecology, no one would know what it was. That would be a crossword puzzle word.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say 1968, was that when you started this plasma technology?
No, it's when I started a company to produce capital equipment for waste that had to do with things as ordinary as balers and shredders and high-density compactors and air transport systems and all sorts of things that handled, in one way or another, municipal solid waste. And, you know, the most technology that appear to have breakthroughs is sort of a taffy pull of a long chain of predecessor items that led through the path to the one, let's say, more dramatic achievement. Saying that badly, but it was product development that led us to the plasma converter. It was not, as compared to running out of a laboratory saying, "Eureka, look at the trick we can do. Who will reward me for this?"
Right. So you were a need, need is the mother of
this.
Invention
point, yes.
Is the... I can't remember the phrase.
Neither the mother invention. Well, yes, In this case, yes, indeed, because quite honestly, and I don't mean to be cynical, but there are so many good things, good, tricky, and I don't mean to trivialize that, devices that have no commercial value, and they languish as technical capabilities. But so one has to have a technical capability, and then it has to walk through the minefield of commercial, all of the commercial hurdles, to see if it's really going to be a commercial product. I don't know if that makes any sense, but...
Sure. So that said, when did you start in this particular, what is now StarTech, this environmental corporation, to use a plasma arc method of converting a solid or liquid waste stream into a syngas, synthetic gas coming out? And there's also, isn't there a solid portion or a liquid that turns into solid coming out?
Well, yes, I'll answer the former question as to when, but back to the most immediate aspect of the... For there are many materials for which that turn into... There's only two ways out of the vessel. Number one is a gas, PCG, the synthesis gas, or as a melt. For example, if we were processing tires, much of the, I'll call it rubbery material, would go off as a gas, properly so and valuable, and the steel belting in the tire would go off as metal, iron, and that would be for pig iron, fundamentally. And now, on the other hand, if we were doing contaminated soil, it would be an enormous amount of a black, glassy material produced and not much PCG. And on the third hand, I don't know what kind of creature has three hands, but on the third hand, if we had changed the solvents, all of that would go off as a gas, and there would be no solid melt. The melt is a very small, when we look at all kinds of waste that we're dealing with, the melt is a very small portion by and large.
Mm-hmm. Do you try and keep it down? Do you try and stick with inflow that has a small melt on the backside?
No, we'll take it as it comes. We're going to be doing a job for the Ministry of Defense, the UK Ministry of Defense, to handle asbestos for certain products that they have. That they have to remediate, and asbestos is just like, kind of like melting rock, and whatever goes into the vessel is going to be destroyed. It just so happens there's so many other things going into the vessel that sometimes
you can effectively put anything on the input, correct? You could put a couch. Yeah. You'd have to grind it down to a small enough size, but you could put any material on the input, and it takes it down to elemental form, and then you have a gas and a melt that comes off.
That's exactly right, Sterling.
But, of course, we're not going to be wanting to put a brand-new car through this thing, so we want to go to waste products or hazardous waste, things that we want to get rid of. Starting with the things we want to get rid of the most. What about nuclear waste? Do we get rid of the radioactive component when we go through this process, or does that still linger?
No, the radioactive component, if we could do that trick, that'll be another business. We don't change the isotopes, but the vast amount of so-called radioactive waste is what's, again, euphemistically called low-level radioactive waste. You know, it sounds like you can rub it on your face and it won't hurt you. It's just the contrary. But low-level radioactive waste is really material that a civilian looking at it would look like household waste. It's paper and wipes and suits and things of that sort, things that are radioactive or could be radioactive by virtue of their proximity to a nuclear operation. And that we would reduce the volume of greatly, but we don't have any applications about that now, although we've talked about it.
Sounds like we just lost our guest.
No, I'm still here.
Oh, okay, you just cut off. Could you repeat what you said?
Oh, boy.
About the... you were talking... We lost about the last, 10 seconds or so. So
I'll capsulize. Okay. I said what the term... When radioactive waste is a term, a euphemism designed to make the innocent more comfortable... And it's called low-level radioactive waste. And it doesn't mean it won't hurt you if you get involved in it. But that would even include materials such as one is injected with in a hospital, scintillating vials to light up tumors and things of that sort. And we can reduce the volume of that greatly, and although not the radioactivity. But the biggest problem with low-level radioactive waste is the great volume of it as compared to its inherent radioactivity. It's just one of the problems.
So that's a separate industry to tackle that problem.
Yes, and it's it is a separate industry, and the one before us, which is everything else, is, you know, quite enormous, as you would imagine. I also should say we keep talking about waste, but we're talking about many applications now of taking coal to produce ethanol from it, and as to whether, I don't know that one would regard coal as a waste, but the term waste is subjective anyway. As I said to someone, if you have a moment, I mean, we all decide what waste is or what it isn't by virtue of our disposition of the material. And if my in-laws aren't listening, when I get my zebra stripe pajamas for Christmas, they immediately become a waste. They're not my gifts. But it's only we and no one else that decides when a thing is a waste. And it's a subjective. It's not inherent of the material.
Right. And with this technology, we may actually rephrase, and in a generation from now, we may not even use the term waste. We may call it, something that has to do with the destination this item is to be turned into energy or turned into syngas. So instead of a waste bin, it'll be a syngas bin.
You know, Sterling, you make a very good point. You obviously can see this, and I kid with people a little bit when we talk about the municipal solid waste or household waste. I say from now on, show a little respect because there's a lot of good stuff there. And indeed, but you make a very, very good point. We might call
it. So you could go to a coal facility, for example, where they're mining coal. And they have to throw away a lot of stuff that just is not high grade enough to be able to run to their burners. And so you have these stacks of stuff. I can't remember offhand what it's called, but it's basically low-level coal, for lack of better term. And you could turn that into ethanol.
Boy, Sterling, you know a thing or two. I might compliment you because you're right on. As a matter of fact, specifically, we're dealing now with a very large contract for what we'll call it low-level coal. It's called brown coal in Australia, otherwise called lignite, but about two-thirds of the value of black coal, so to speak. But that has value as well. But you're right. It's again, we don't much care what the material is. It'll be processed in the converter. And for most things, it can produce a feedstock synthesis gas that can be used then for many, many other things.
What about the waste oil coming from automobile usage? When I change my oil, I take it down to the local automotive store. I give it to them, and from there, it could go to StarTech, the local distributor or local plant, and they then can convert it into almost all gas. Is that correct?
It's correct. That's mother's milk. I mean, that's really good stuff. And a matter of speaking, there's a wonderful circularity. Mother Nature and her cauldron produced these materials billions of years ago, and we've taken them and done a lot of magical things with them, industry and all of that, and come around again to the plasma converter, and we kind of bring it back to Mother Nature's components once again. And for me, the circularity of it somehow pleases me, but you get the idea. You got the idea completely.
Yeah, let's talk about what you do with the melt that comes off. What are some of the uses of the melt?
Well, in Japan, we have them developing building blocks. They like the idea of using things to build things, paving blocks and building blocks and all of that. And you know, the question will be, well, how many darn building blocks can you do? But the best use is as an aggregate fill for construction. It's a good inert aggregate fill. Or if you were down in our facility in Bristol, we would show you it as ground-up material we call black beauty that can be used as what's called a blast media. And that's sandblasting material to clean steel and vessels and all of that. So it has a lot of very good industrial uses. Also, you will see a building product being developed, obsidian, glassy obsidian, along with a foam material to build a construction product that's both load-carrying and fire-resistant and So there's a lot of things being done with that, but we're not doing any of that ourselves. We have so many very smart people with whom we're associated. They're taking these tasks and developing all these capabilities, and they tend to make us look good, but they're taking that on themselves.
Uh-huh. Now, in terms of the syngas, let's talk about the syngas end of it. What's the destination of the syngas?
Well, the syngas, if you were an older fellow such as I, probably, if a person were more than 55, generally, it's likely if they were an East Coast person, they probably would have grown up with mom cooking dinner on manufactured gas, on a gas stove. And that was before there was natural gas piped in. But that manufactured gas, the synthesis gas, is exactly the kind of gas that comes out of the vessel. As a matter of fact, Hitler ran his war on manufactured gas, coal gas to ethanol, you know, starting back in the late 30s. So it's been around a long time. I mean, Gaslight, the Gaslight you see in quaint old films about Gaslight on the street, that gas was not natural gas. People didn't even know what natural gas was. It was manufactured gas, and that's a synthesis gas. And its composition is principally hydrogen in the form of H2 and CO, carbon monoxide. And a lot of people say carbon monoxide, but that's a poison. Well, we can talk about that as well, but that's the composition of synthesis gas.
Okay. And so you could use the existing infrastructure, the natural gas infrastructure, and run syngas through it?
Yes, that's where the great interest is these days. Again, it's particularly in Panama, where they really want that. In some respects, they're more enchanted with the back end, and I call the back end where the gas comes out, than they are on the front end where the waste goes in, so to speak. Yes, so there's a lot of interest all over the world now, with many applications of what can be done with the synthesis gas, and beyond doing electricity or extracting hydrogen, the most prevalent uses now in contractual discussion are for the production of ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel, ethanol, and jet fuel and propane.
And the plants that you have in operation now, what is the preponderance of the output there?
It's a synthesis gas, but they're not interested in the synthesis gas, because they're primarily interested in the one in China and Japan and Bristol. They're really interested in the front end, processing the materials at the front end. It's only the much bigger ones, in the hundreds of tons today, that it makes sense. As a matter of fact, we tell the municipalities we're talking to, you have to pay attention to the back end, because you're going to have so much PCG. You got to think about being serious about what you're going to do with it, because there's a lot of it.
So you, confusing you with another company, but it seems like you had a process whereby you, even a not proprietary, a patent-protected process for actually taking the syngas and converting it effectively, efficiently into some of the other things you're talking about, the diesel, the propane, and whatnot.
Well, you know, the patents are sort of specious, if I may. I mean, the conversion of synthesis gas to a fuel, I mean, it must be 80 years old, with major companies having done that. Now, they do it by reformation processes, not using a plasma converter, but nevertheless, the idea of having a synthesis gas to a fuel is old stuff. As a matter of fact, as I say, Hitler fought World War II doing that.
In terms of the plant size, how small and how big, how small would be getting to the point where it would be no longer economical, and how big would be, is there such a thing as too big?
Yes, good question, Sterling. the smallest we're doing now is about 5 tons a day. Because if one wanted 3 tons a day, the price of the equipment would be essentially the same. However, we're working on developments to really downscale it to about, like 200 pounds a day for high-rise apartments and laboratories, et cetera. Going the other way, we are quoting systems up to 1,000 tons a day, plants. But the ones we have in contract now are three plants in Panama for 200 tons a day each. So the tendency is to have home rule with regard to municipal solid waste, for the community now to be self-sufficient and to get away from these monstrous plants, these incinerators that you'll see around, to get away from that and get back in some respects to the way a community handled its waste 30 years ago with regional facilities. And so that's why, for example, Panama needs about 2,200 tons per day, and therefore we'll be having 7 or 8 of these things logistically located throughout Panama to cut down on the traffic and et cetera.
In terms of the economic, you're turning waste, what used to be considered waste, and we talked earlier about the definition of waste, we're turning what used to be considered waste into a very usable, feasible product. So there's a lot of, of course, the process itself, is going to be consume some of your resources, but what kind of economics are we talking about in terms of an investment and a return on investment?
Well, good question. It's an enormous question, of course, but what we do, when we talk to potential customers, immediately we move to, if it's a for-profit company, we move to construct with them, with their data, a profit and loss statement. And if it's a not-for-profit company, such as a hospital or municipality, then we talk about the budget. The system has to be making money for the buyer, we say, or else he's really not a customer. Even though, I mean, we can't necessarily, we'd like to, but we would sort of like to be able to say, now, look, sir, you should eat your vegetables and be more environmentally conscientious. But the approach we take is the safest one by way of the pocketbook, and we get to that right away. So we clear away any question about whether or not this customer is a likely candidate or not.
When do you see a time, this I guess scenario I'm going to present to you is probably one that you haven't thought of, not that you're not creative enough, just because it's kind of off the wall, just something that came to me while we were talking here. How long will it be before, as we're driving down the road, I can throw my banana peel in a bin in my car and it turns it into electricity to help propel me down the road?
Well, as a matter of fact, probably, I want to answer it two ways. In terms of the theory of the idea, you're right on, because that's exactly, you throw banana peels in this big thing and hydrogen will come out the other end, and it certainly can propel an automobile, as we've demonstrated. Now, there could come a time, probably off into the future, with young men a lot smarter than I, wherein this will be downsized, wherein it could possibly, that could possibly happen. You know, that's a scene, as I recall, out of Back to the Future, but it's a heck of a provocative scene. But that process is here right now. It's just a matter of scale.
All right. Now, of course, that was in the Back to the Future, or science fiction, but the theory was somewhat more nuclear-based than actually molecular-based. Yet there's still, and the point is that we can take a banana peel and turn it into energy. I get confused a little bit in the people that I've talked to, but it seems like it was somebody from your company that was talking about the day coming when we would be able to have each home having its own recycle unit, so that you could go out into the garage, throw your refuse into a home unit. And what kind of issues are there with startups? You probably want to keep these things running in an industrial setting for the most optimal use, wouldn't you?
Sure. The first thing, let me come back to the first part of the question As I recall it, I forget the guy's name, something Lloyd, the wonderful character from Taxi, Christopher Lloyd, I think. He called his gizmo his thrust capacitor, a great name, whatever the heck that meant. But right now, literally, banana skins into the converter will produce a PCG comprised of CO and H2. The H2 can be separated and put into an automobile and run. And we have done that already. But back again now to this more futuristic question on a downsizing, the scaling down. The first downscaling subject target will be high-rise apartment houses. And then maybe there'll be something for the home, or maybe not. But if there's a provocative thought about high-rise apartment houses and cities there, because if there were plasma converters in apartment houses, the volume reduction of that material would be about 400 to 500 to 1 of inert material. And that means all of a sudden there's an enormous change of infrastructure with the city-run Department of Sanitation vehicles. Instead of picking up once or twice a week, perhaps they pick up once a month or every 2 months. So it has, like so much technology, there are ramifications that arise from it that are very provocative and interesting. But that's in the cards.
Yeah, a picture comes to mind as you talk about that, of the strike in New York City of the Department of Waste, yes, where the trash starting to stack up in the, yes, streets. And it didn't take a day or two before people started really feeling that.
Yes.
And I can't remember how long they were on strike, but I remember seeing pictures from that. And, you know, even on a practical emergency preparedness type of mindset, if our infrastructure were to be impaired somehow through some kind of a terrorist or other incident, and we were not able to be mobile as we are now, somehow the fuel was cut off, right now we would be sitting ducks for massive breakdown of societal order, people going into rioting and looting, trash building up in the streets would lead to disease. In no order, I mean, it would take no time at all before, you know, our clean cities turned into massive dumps. And if we had these units installed in these high-rises and whatnot, where they're self-powered, essentially, they're producing electricity and getting rid of the waste so that that refuse situation is mitigated.
That's exactly the... Sterling, you have designed the model. That's exactly right. And further, cynically, it just so happens that when there are union strikes and all, they just happen to be in the hottest parts of the summer to make the problem of putrescible materials even more obnoxious. But you have your finger right on it. That is going to be coming. I mean, that's within our vision right now. It's not, well, it's doable with focus of time and some money and energy. Yes, that's doable.
Let's talk about money for a second. We've talked about the economy of an individual installation, return on investment. But let's talk about where you are as a company. Are you, most of the energy companies that are kind of out ahead of the pack in a leadership role, pushing new technologies, are in a world of hurt for money. They need money to be able to develop. They need money to be able to get the prototype to the next stage. They need money to be able to implement a production prototype, et cetera. There's this huge need for money. Where are you sitting in regards to your need for capitalization?
Well, there have been about $20 million or so put into this development over the years, and we're long past the so-called research or the prototype. We're long past that, and now we are selling commercial systems, and we will be... we'd probably do about 30 or 40 million in sales this year and be profitable. But again, the important thing is that we really started actively on this, oh gosh, about 1988, and a lot of money has been put into it. And the way it happens, Sterling, is one doesn't decide in 1988, well, we're going to have $20 million to spend. It's sort of a slice of salami at a time, and pretty soon you have the whole salami, so to speak.
Well, you know, obviously you're going into and turning this technology into a mainstream. I would consider popular science to kind of be a signature or a telltale sign that you have arrived as a technology whose time has come and who is now now ready to go into popular acceptance and implementation. What kind of interest and spur of interest have you gotten from that popular science coverage?
Well, we won the Wall Street Journal Best and Brightest Technology a couple of years ago, and that was important. But the response to popular science has been enormous, absolutely enormous. And now, there were a couple of errors in it. Let me just call it inaccuracies. But with all of that writing and all the interviews we have, that's inevitable. Inaccuracy is nothing to fuss about. But the response has been enormous all over the world.
Mm-hmm. And how ready are you to handle the increased interest that people are expressing to... I mean, I would imagine if I was a mayor of my town, I would be wanting to get on the horn with you to get one of these things in our city.
Well, we have... We just had the folks from New Orleans, Katrina, come up last week, and we have Japanese municipality and Mexico, Mexican municipalities coming up this forthcoming week. Where we have, it's all we can do right now for staffing up. What we don't do is make any sales calls. What we do is respond to all of the initiatives coming at us. And we have six young engineering sales associates handling the incoming traffic, and I also and some others handle some incoming traffic on the bigger project. So it's been a problem, and people say, well, yeah, it's a good problem. And it is a good problem, but by golly, it is a problem.
And what kind of rate of implementation are you able to handle now, and where will you be 6 months, a year from now, in terms of number of I guess we could call it tons per day. Where are you at today in terms of tons per day active processing, and where will you be in 6 months from now?
Well, the market is comprised, as I say, coming at us on the larger scale on municipal modules of about 200 tons per day, and we have three contracts for those now. Panama, with others behind it, and then we have a handful of 10 and 25 ton per day systems. I see the foreseeable future will be in systems about that size. I mean, for example, in the Philippines, they're telling us they want 8,000 tons a day, but they have no idea what an 8,000 ton per day facility would look like, and so we're helping them think that through. Our job, since I believe we're experts, to help the communities and the waste generators and the waste processors think through how best to handle the waste and the plasma converters, etc.
Okay, so you've talked about contracts. Installed capacity do you have right now? Is everything on the drawing board right now, or do you have installed capacity?
We have three 5-ton-a-day systems installed and contracts in... we're long past the drawing board, but they'll probably be... this year we'll probably have a short order, a contract for 25 tons a day, 200 tons a day, and a handful of 10 ton-a-day systems. And our delivery time we're quoting is about 12 months' time.
Okay, so if I were to get my local waste management person excited about this, and he wanted to install one of these, and we called you up, what kind of response would we get? And would you are you going to start out with a set size and kind of mass produce that, or are you going to stay tailored made? And what's the best model for you? Is it mass production, or is it basically building per inquiry?
Well, this kind of equipment is, in the manufacturing parlance, would be called small lot size production. That would be 5 or 10 units at a time. Unlike, let's say, tennis shoes or wheelbarrows or forklifts. And what we would do with regard to the inquiry, we really sort of have to do triage to see how serious the inquiry is, because we get so many. But on the assumption it is serious, we would the best thing to do, we'd talk to the fellow about his specifics, help him think that through and get him down to meet us and see the facility in operation. So to get his mind more equipped to talk further about the project, it's important that they see the system because, it's hard for them to sit back and think about what 10 questions can they ask that will achieve the enlightenment they seek. So we want to have the interchange as the most productive thing.
Mm-hmm. So back to my question, let's say if I were to approach you on behalf of my city and said we want one of these, we're sold on the idea, or we want to just do some last-minute checking, we want to go down and see your beta test, how long, you're saying 12 months out from the time that we sit down and write up a contract to the time that you would be able to deliver and install?
Sure, but what we first do is try to get you down to talk to us so we can move to the specifics and join with you on the thinking as to what is most suitable for whatever the application is, big city, little city, et cetera, all sorts of conditions that we think we're relatively expert on. But at the time a contract is signed, right now it would be about a 12-month delivery time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, sometimes it takes a year and a half for the customer to circle around, do the due diligence and kick the tires and have all the thoughts. And when they decide, the human condition is when they decide that they want to put their money down on the line, so to speak, they want it immediately. But of course, we keep telling them it's going to be 11 or 12 month delivery, but we're fine.
Mm-hmm.
That people understand.
Are you looking at increasing or expanding your production end of things?
We are. That's what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. Are you entertaining licensing for that?
No, we would never license the technology because that's giving over the technology to someone else, and there's no need to do that. We can build these things. The transportation cost to anywhere in the world is a very, very small amount as compared to the capital cost, and one could literally be producing these things in Antarctica and ship to London, and the shipping transportation cost is not a barrier. So we wouldn't want to pass over. When one license, you really give over everything to the licensee, and we will not do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, in another technology I'm familiar with that is also a breakthrough revolutionary type of technology, there's an issue with IP, and the response is that, well, even if GM and GE both were to devote all of their existing resources to building this device and distributing it, it would take 10 years before we reach 20% market saturation. And so would you say in your industry that you're not too concerned about competitors or knockoffs?
Well, I'm always, learned to be paranoid through my life. There has never been a case, and this is going to sound really zany, where we have faced a competitor face-to-face across the board. However, there is room for competition. Now, with regard to knockoffs, the phrase is called reverse engineering. It's very, very difficult to reverse engineering a system such as ours and a GM or a GE. And if GM or GE wanted to do that, they'd just go buy StarTech and wouldn't fool around with all the other craziness of copying and all the enormous technical problems, and we can talk about that, but just buy it. That's the easy thing to do. And not that we're for sale.
Right. Do you ever, you're not for sale now, but you do see at some point, that's typically the model it will take with like GE or GM, is they wait until somebody has played Pioneer for 5 years, they've got 1,000 units installed, worked out all the bugs, then they come in and they buy it up and they fine-tune the model and ramp it up. Do you see yourself going through that process at any point, or do you see yourself staying at the helm and in charge the entire time from now till 50 years from now?
I would think that's in the cards. I'll come back. Before I started this company, when I worked for the Fortune 500 company called AMF to help build their business, if we saw something we liked, we didn't try to copy it. We just bought it. But coming back, of course, we're StarTech. Our stock market symbol is STHK, And therefore, I tell you that not to be selling shares, but my fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders is if there's an offer that comes in from someone that is favorable to the shareholders, I've got my covenant with the shareholders is to bring that to their attention. But we're not on the market. Whether or not I like it or not is a matter of indifference. But if not, one has to be careful about management entrenchment, wherein they'll block things of that sort for the purposes of the entrenched management at the detriment of shareholders. But so I sound like I'm talking about the flag and motherhood. But if something comes in that is bona fide, we'll, you know, vet it and all of that. But that would go to us first, our directors, and then shareholders to comment on.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of your shares, your stock symbol is STHK. I'm looking at Yahoo Finance right now, and I'm seeing most recently in March, where we see this Popular Science article come out, your share price goes up to $3.50. If I'm reading this right,
that's probably right.
Yeah, and it was kind of low around mid February, and then it was high again in mid January, or maybe that was December. But there was kind of a gradual decline starting around January. Around mid 2004. You went a really high peak starting just before like December 2003, going, it just jumped like crazy up to like five. What was that initial hype, for lack of a more better term, and then the gradual decline, and then there was a little hump again in January 06, and then another decline. Could you maybe talk about those incidences? What brought that about?
Well, it's a good observation, and I'll be among the last to know about how all of that works. But we have, there are profit takers, et cetera, that, you know, nothing wrong with that. Shares go up to sell some shares at a lower level and take profit, and the share price goes down. But there's nothing of consequence going on except news releases that we produce that are factual, and sometimes a news release will pick up greater interest than another. But we operate, we're fully reporting, and we really have to operate with enormous correctness with regard to SEC considerations. But I really don't know. It looked to me like there was great interest from Popular Science and maybe some profit taking now, and I have all sorts of people, as you can imagine, calling me with their theories and the chartists and all of that. But what we're doing is keeping our nose to the grindstone and banging away. We're going to build systems and sell systems, and the market will behave the way it behaves.
Right. I can understand how sometimes, you know, people will run with information, and it's a bit of a bubble type of effect. But it just looking at this, quite dramatic. I'm looking at a five-year chart here, and you kind of declined the entire 2002, and then for an entire year, you went from $3 to $1 over the course of about a year. Then you sat at $1 for about a year, and then in the course of about a month, you jumped from $1 to $4.50. Sat there for a year. And then it gradually declined for the next year, and then you have a hump in the next year. It's curious to me. I'm just wondering what was the story that caused that huge jump over a month from $1 to $4.50 that lasted a year before and after.
Well, the only aberrant thing that happened during the period is from the period of all through 2000, and I'm not looking at the share price because I got to keep my eye on moving ahead as compared to looking backwards. But nevertheless, during the period of the year 2000 to halfway through 2003, I stepped out into retirement and let someone else run the company. And some things didn't happen the way they should have. And so I don't know how that ties into whatever the numbers are, but that's quite honestly I don't much care. I got to keep focused on what I'm doing today and tomorrow.
But there is so that, maybe the answer to that question would be somebody else in your company who's more following that kind of thing. Well, we have a couple minutes left in the show. I really appreciate you coming on, and let's maybe wrap it up a little bit, cover anything that we've not covered. Is there anything that comes to mind in you?
Certainly, I will mention something your audience might find interesting, a human thing. Toward the end of the article, and when the editors were extracting the last bit of information from Popular Science, they asked the question, what was the largest challenge I faced? And I thought I was going to respond technically about some gizmo we were developing or not, but backed off with some perspective, and I said to them, the biggest challenge was the fact that it was a new idea, and worse than that, it was a really new idea. And boy, oh boy, new ideas, they have a hard time, you know, and people say they love new ideas. They might like a new car, a new airplane, new software, but really new ideas, something very much a part of their normal life, is takes a long time to get people comfortable with it, and that has been the biggest challenge.
Mm-hmm. So it's the fact that it's still, you know, it's still cutting teeth, so to speak, and you're not, you know, this baby has come out, but you're not, you know, it's still in early stages, and there's still a lot of wait and see attitude, maybe.
There is, as a matter of fact, a good point. That's exactly the case. We have lots of customers now who are comfortable, that have done, in some cases, 3 years of due diligence. And it's a lot easier now than it was 5 years ago, because there are others contracting and all of that. But it's still, you know, a little bit new and a little bit scary. That'll change. You know, it's sort of like an airplane. I mean, there was a time when a thing you drove into today with the four wheels and a steering wheel, you know, in the early 100 years ago, that was still referred to as a horseless carriage, certainly not a vehicle. You know, clearly a thing that was an intrusion on a more civilized way of life at the time. So things like that happen. And we're a disruptive technology.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a technology that in 20 years from now, and that's typically the amount of time it takes for something like this to reach 80-90% saturation, every landfill will be replaced by this, and it'll be on a local level. Rather than hauling your garbage 10, 15, 30 miles, it'll be half a mile to the local StarTech installation.
Yes, Sterling, that is actually happening right now. Not perhaps in your community, but, you know, there's a handful of communities around the world. But where it is happening, so and that'll make it easier for those a little more guarded, and more cautious about not wanting to be among the first. Nothing wrong with that.
Tell us your website.
It's StarTech.net, www. But if anyone wants it, it's just Google in StarTech, one word, StarTech.net. And you'll see more, you know, more stuff than you even care to about us, I think.
And if you type in StarTech in Google, I think our coverage comes up second after yours. That's the Wiki. Yeah. We'll put this our story up on the archives, and I really appreciate you joining us. This has been Sterling Allen interviewing CEO of StarTech, Joe. Is it Longo or Lane? How do you pronounce your
Longo,
last name?
Like Congo. Longo, right. Mm-hmm. That's Joe Longo.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you,
appreciate
Sterling.
You coming on.
Have a good day.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye.